tendency to report my every move to the woman from whom I, at times, desperately want to hide. It is like that for every teenager, I suspect. My mother just has more willing spies than most. The next morning, she wakes me by pacing up and down the hall. Mother waits until she hears me turn over in bed before she peers around the door. I prop myself up on one elbow and resist the urge to dig myself deeper under the covers.
"Oh, you're up," she says in mock surprise. "Good. You have a fitting at 10. You'll need to shower. We'll stop off at Lila's on the way, and she'll figure out something to do with your hair."
I don't see why I have to go. We already know it fits. My weight has evened out now that my appetite is back to normal, and I probably have another month or so before I really start to pack on the pounds. At least that's what Google tells me. Mother sighs and looks at me indulgently.
"The wedding is only a week away. You know they need to air the teaser tomorrow. They'll need some footage of you in the dress."
I sit up and tuck the quilt around my waist, trapping the warmth, and pull the sleeves of my nightgown down over my wrists. I shiver, reluctant to climb fully out of bed.
"It's only a little bit longer, Bug. I know that it all seems overwhelming, but you're almost there. Once the ceremony is over, you won't have to worry about anything ever again."
I start at her use of my old nickname, short for Love Bug, and at her use of the word you instead of we. This is maybe the first time she has given any indication that this is something that is happening to me, not just to her. For a split second, I am sorry about everything. Not only about where I've tried to lead Libby, but about what I intend to do.
"Was this what it was like when you married Daddy?"
"Goodness, no. I think there were barely 50 people at the church that day. We could hardly afford any flowers. I carried a bedraggled bouquet that was mostly baby's breath. It had already begun to rot. I could smell it as I was walking down the aisle. Your father had nothing when I married him. I was the only one who saw the sort of man he had the potential to become."
I wrinkle my forehead. This is not the way she tells the wedding story when the cameras are rolling.
I wonder which version is closer to being true. Impulsively, I say, "But you loved him, right? It was more than just his potential. It was love." Mother looks startled. Her smile is brittle.
"Yes," she says. "Yes, of course. I loved him."
I try to hold her gaze, daring her to admit to some deeper, darker truth. But she only repeats her command to shower and then slips away. Rourke wanted to ask Blake to be his best man, but Mother quashed that idea on the basis that the best man would be in most of the close-ups of the actual ceremony, and she didn't want to have to worry about an amateur fidgeting and ruining the shot, or breaking out with zits and making the whole production look even more like a group of children playing at being adults than was absolutely necessary. In the end, she offered to let Rourke have Blake as one of his groomsmen, and looked affronted when Rourke didn't trip over himself to thank her. Caleb was the superior choice for best man as far as Mother was concerned. She explained her reasoning at length, using the words chiseled features and boyish good looks more than once. She denied that it had anything to do with increasing his visibility for the campaign, but when I suggested using Maddie or Daniel or Jacob instead, she dismissed the idea outright. So it was that Naomi had been assigned the task of being my matron of honor, since Mother has always been a sucker for symmetry. She and Candy debated for a long time whether it would be appropriate to have a pregnant woman standing beside me at the altar, not seeming to appreciate the irony implicit in the question, and finally decided that it was the perfect symbol of what the purpose of marriage really is. Honor God, procreate. Naomi is already in a dusty blue dress when Mother and I arrive at the bridal shop, and she is turning this way and that in front of a mirror made up of three separate panels. The slippery fabric shimmers and accentuates the curve in her lower abdomen. I try not to stare, and Mother rushes to embrace her in an expansive hug.
Naomi, dear, you look lovely, she breathes. You don't think it's too much? My sister-in-law asks meekly. She has always idolized my mother. Her own parents died shortly before she started dating Caleb, and I've always suspected, but never confirmed, that mother paid for Naomi's last year of college. In my more cynical moments, I know it would have been because the relationship was popular with viewers and mother needed Naomi to stay in school. But when I am feeling generous, I recognize that mother probably saw something of herself in her future daughter-in-law. Naomi may have grown up poor, but beneath all her fluff and simpering was the shrewdness that had bought her a life she could have never earned all on her own. Naomi waves a hand in front of her chest, which I take to mean that she is worried about the neckline. Mother tugs on one of the shoulders and lifts Naomi's left breast by an inch. Well, it never hurts to err on the side of modesty, but I think bringing this in just a bit will achieve the necessary coverage and not compromise the line at all. Don't you agree? I step forward to take a closer look, but as it turns out, Mother is not talking to me. A sturdy-looking older woman scurries out from behind a counter, a line of straight pins held between her thin lips. She extracts one of these small metal daggers and jabs it through the fabric at Naomi's bust. Naomi winces but manages to stand still. Mother steps back to give the woman room to work and glances down at her watch. The crew will be here soon. You better go get changed. The pin-wielding woman, whose name I cannot remember, mutters something while keeping her lips pressed tight. I have no earthly clue as to whether she is even speaking English. Her words are so garbled by the pin she is holding. But Mother seems to understand her well enough. She takes my arm and leads me through to the back, where my dress is hanging in the largest of the dressing rooms. I shrug off my sweater and lay it flat on the upholstered bench, then sit to remove my shoes. Mother stands uncertainly for a moment with her hand on the heavy velvet curtain, not sure whether she should wait inside or out. I can't get it on alone, I remind her. Reluctantly, she pulls the curtain and begins to ease the dress out of its bag. The dress is the one thing I chose in this entire wedding. Except for Rourke, that is. Mother had originally picked out a gown with a stiff beaded bodice that made me look 10 years older than I am. But I told her I couldn't breathe in it, and the thought of my passing out on live television was enough to make her relent. In contrast, the dress that Mother is now unwrapping makes me feel light as air. Slipping beneath its layers of tulle is like being wrapped in a cloud that has been backlit by the sun. The delicate beadwork of flowers and vines wends its way over the chest and shoulders and makes me look no more and no less than the 17 years I am. It's the only honest thing about this entire production, and I am surprised to find that I love it. Once I saw my reflection that first time in the mirror, I knew there was no way I could do this wearing anything else. It is the exact opposite of the sort of dress I used to clip out of magazines and pin to my paper dolls. Those were big, poofy concoctions of satin and lace, with layers of skirt gathered up in rosettes. Lissa never wanted to play at getting married, which was strange because she usually went along good-naturedly with most of my little girl games. At first, I thought it was because she was too old. Later, I began to suspect it was because she thought that getting married meant you turned into someone like our mother, and I could not blame her for wanting to avoid such a fate. Now, I know it was more than that. Mother finishes gathering the layers of the skirt up over her arms as I wriggle into the undergarments I have taken from their own hook. I reach above my head and lean forward, and Mother slides the gown from her own arms onto mine. The fabric falls down over my shoulders, and as it does, I feel like I am standing outside during a summer shower, warm and cool at the same time, with the small hairs on my forearms standing to attention. I feel Mother tug at the buttons at my back, and then wave her hands in frustration. I'll go get Mrs. Riley. She must have a hook of some sort to help with these, A few minutes pass, and Mrs. Riley, mouth now empty of pins, stomps her way back into the dressing room. She uses something that looks like a medieval torture device to thread the small pearl buttons through their loops. When she has finished, she holds the curtain back so I can pass into the hall. The full skirt rustles as I move and brushes against the walls. The cameras are rolling when I walk back into the showroom, and Mrs. Riley hustles me over to a small raised dais at the center of the room. Hillary and Lucy have arrived as well, and are sitting primly with Naomi, each trying to win the award for best sister-in-law by pretending the sight of me might make her cry. They urge me to twirl, and I protest in embarrassment, but then give in, letting the air fill my dress and lift the skirt off the floor. "Not bad," a voice says from behind me. I feel my heart trip in my chest as I turn to see Lissa standing there. "What are you doing here?" Mother demands as she charges across the room and then, remembering the cameras, smiles and turns this attack into a stiff embrace. "Making sure you don't send my baby sister down the aisle looking like a meringue. I needn't have worried, though. She looks just lovely." Mother squirms, trying to figure out just how closely Lissa and I have kept in touch, whether we might have been sneaking messages to each other all these years. "It's only that I never expected you to come, to drive all this way," Mother lets out haltingly. "I thought you were indisposed." Lissa smiles broadly, enjoying the effect she is having on our mother. "My little sister is getting married. I wouldn't miss this for the world." The sisters-in-law twitter something about how of course she wouldn't miss the wedding, and they all trade kisses and compliment Lissa's hair, and say that we really ought to get together more often, because it feels like ages since we've all been in the same room. At the periphery of the reunion, the cameras circle like predators, zooming in for a close-up of Hillary looking Lissa up and down, and telling her she's gotten too thin. Of Lucy demanding that Lissa come over soon for a home-cooked meal. While this goes on, I stand as still as I can to avoid being skewered by Mrs. Riley, who is putting on her own show for the cameras, by pinning my dress and then letting it out again. When she has finished, she steps away and throws her hands up with a flourish. There are the expected murmurs of admiration. I tried to keep from fidgeting as the cameras zoom in. "It's perfect. I know that Rourke will love it," Lissa tells me.
"Oh, you've met Rourke?"
Naomi says. Her voice is too bright, as if she is trying to cover up for Mother's scowl. She does not wait for Lissa to answer the question before asking another. "Isn't he just a prince? I think if I were 10 years younger and single myself, I might try to fight Essie for him." Naomi giggles, a high-pitched, nervous sort of sound. Lissa starts laughing as well, so hard that she has to wipe at her eyes. It's a while before she can catch her breath. "But then you'd have to give up being married to Caleb." "Don't be ridiculous. He's in a class of his own." Something about Lissa's tone feels dangerous. I have never thought of Naomi as being particularly clever, but even she can sense it. She quickly says, "Of course, I was only joking." Lissa's smile broadens at this, and she echoes, "Of course. I know that, sis." There's an uncomfortable silence, and Mrs. Riley tries to fill it by fluffing out my dress. Hillary rewards her efforts and says, "Essie, you look truly breathtaking." Mother moves forward to take my hand, and then steps back as if relishing this moment. It looks as if she is trying to force a tear. Eventually, she gives up, but she dabs at her eyes with a lace handkerchief nonetheless, and breathes in sharply through her nose.
"My baby," she croaks helplessly, "is all grown up."
It is all I can do not to punch her. But then she is pulled away as my sisters-in-law surround her and try to soothe her as the four of them embrace. Naomi is crying, which makes me like her more since she is too poor an actress for the tears to not be real. I think it is possible that she is actually a good person,
and for a moment, I am sorry. She will be all right, I know. But there will still be fallout. Collateral damage, that's what they all will be. Still, I tell myself, they have it coming. Lyssa has given up trying to hide her amusement, but at least she has stepped back a little so that she is behind the camera. They will still be able to use this shot. When the snuffling and reassurances have gone on long enough, Lyssa steps back into frame. Her timing is perfect. She clearly remembers how this game is played. So, she says, causing the group to break up and turn to face her, where's my bridesmaid's dress? A gust of wind rattles the door from outside, and there is a faint tinkling from the bell hung over the frame. To Mother's credit, she does not pause for too long before saying, "But you never sent us your measurements, darling. Never mind that now. Let's have Mrs. Riley take them today. I'm sure she can whip something up in time." Mrs. Riley scurries off to find a measuring tape, only to realize eventually that she has one draped about her neck. I step off the small platform, and Lyssa takes my place. Obediently, she twists and turns and holds her arms out to the side. Mrs. Riley makes note of the size of Lyssa's hips and waist and bust, scribbling the numbers down on a pad of paper she has extracted from a hidden pocket. Lincoln, who is in charge of the camera crew, whispers something to Mother, and they pack up to go. While Mrs. Riley finishes up with Lyssa, Lucy begins telling Hillary and Naomi a story about how her own wedding dress almost didn't fit. But Mother cuts her off and tells her to take me back to the dressing room and get me out of that thing. Gamely, Lucy struggles with the buttons and stows my dress back in its bag. She leaves me to change out of the slip and back into my own clothes, and as I do, I hear Lyssa casually telling the others about school. When I come back into the room, Mother makes it clear that she does not want to linger. So I hug everyone and thank them for coming, leaving Lyssa for last. She squeezes me tight and then releases me, saying, "I'll see you at the rehearsal." Mother rolls her eyes and walks out the door. She waits in the car while Mrs. Riley helps me hang my dress in the back seat. There are separate bags for the slip and the veil. The shoes are already at home, though they are not likely to be visible at all. I had argued that I should be able to wear sneakers since they would be more comfortable and I would be less likely to trip and fall, but Mother insisted on heels. Anything else would be unladylike, she said. I wanted to tell her that any chance I had of being ladylike had been taken away a long time ago, but I did not think it would help my cause. So I bit my tongue. Mother says nothing to me for the whole ride home. I did not really expect her to. There would be too many witnesses. The day has warmed up and Mother has rolled down the car windows. The air smells alive and I prop my arm out of the window to soak in the sun, until Mother tells me to bring it back inside and says something about how ridiculous I would look if I got married with a sunburn on one arm. I tell her that the entire car ride is less than 10 minutes, but she pretends not to hear, and I obediently fold my hands in my lap. Mother slows the car to wave at Mr. Leonid, who is walking his dog, and then pulls over to compliment Betty Melmer on her geraniums and to ask her to please send over her lemon cake recipe when she finds the time. Mrs. Melmer tells Mother that it was her great-aunt's recipe and promises to copy it out and have it in the mail by the end of the day. We continue to roll slowly through town, with Mother shouting something out of her window every block or so. A woman I don't know rushes over to tell Mother that the Hartnetts might be getting a divorce. Mother nods sagely, and then we continue on our way. Finally, we pull into our driveway. I make no move to get out of the car, assuming that Mother will want to say something to me first, but she opens her door without even looking in my direction and walks toward the house. There will be shouting then, shouting that she doesn't want anyone to hear. I gather my things and bow my head and follow her inside. Still, I am somehow unprepared when she fixes me with her eyes and quietly says, "What the hell was that?" It is not just the swear. A word I have never heard come from her mouth. It is the fact that she does not even trust herself to yell. She is that angry. What? I ask, even though I know it will only make her all the more furious. Mother practically snarls. Don't you even try to play dumb with me. What was she doing there? She told you herself. She wanted to see the dress, that's all. I shrug and try to walk away, but Mother grabs my arm, her bony fingers pressing into my flesh. Careful, I say evenly. You wouldn't want any bruises to show up on the live wedding feed. Mother gasps and takes a step back. I have never talked to her that way before. She looks frightened of me, and there is a part of me that wants nothing more than to show her just how frightening I can be. But I also know that I am not yet out of danger, and I won't be until the wedding airs. Isn't it better this way? I try instead. I mean, how exactly were we going to explain it if she didn't even come to the wedding? People may have been satisfied these past 3.5 years that she just wanted to concentrate on school, but surely there would be questions if she couldn't manage to make it down from Chicago for something as important as this. Yes, but even so, how did she know? How did she know about today? I see that I need to calm Mother down, so I say, Gretchen has been live-tweeting everything about the wedding, hasn't she? You asked her to keep the fans informed every step along the way. I'll bet she tweeted something about the fitting. That must be how Lissa knew exactly where we'd be. Mother's shoulders relax visibly. Yes, that must be it. I should leave it here, I know, but I cannot resist. I kiss Mother on the cheek. Thank you for asking her to be a bridesmaid. Thank you for knowing how important that is to me. I do not give Mother a chance to say that it was Lissa herself who volunteered for the role, who strong-armed Mother into it by doing so on camera. Instead, I race up the stairs to my room and turn on the radio. When I am sure that Mother has not followed me, I take out Margot's phone and type a note to Libby. I hope you found what I left for you. It's every page of every diary I ever kept. The wedding will only be the beginning. People are going to want to know the rest. I trust you. Once I am sure the message has been delivered, I hide the phone again, then skip lightly back downstairs. Mother looks startled as I enter the kitchen. She is sitting at the counter with her hands wrapped around her favorite coffee cup, the one that Daddy bought her at Hershey Park. She is not doing anything but sitting, which is unusual. She must still be shaken over seeing Lissa. I'm famished, I tell her cheerfully. I think I'll make some French toast. Do you want any? No, thank you, she answers primly and stands to go. Then from the hallway I hear, Be careful you don't eat too much. Mrs. Riley is a miracle worker. But I don't think she can make your dress get any bigger.
Liberty. The flash drive is on my bedside table where I left it, when Mike pulls open the curtains, a towel around his waist and his toothbrush tucked inside his cheek. He looks down in the direction of the courtyard, grunts, and shuffles back toward the bathroom.
Mr. Danziger is torturing his dog again.
He manages around the toothbrush. I hear him spit. Then he says more clearly,
We really ought to call someone.
I tuck my head down underneath the covers so that I'm looking at the flash drive, as if from within a tunnel. Who exactly are we supposed to call? I don't think animal cruelty laws apply to people who dress their pets up like Ewoks.
Well, they should.
Mike proclaims, and starts riffling through his closet to find something to wear.
You working from home today?
I nod, then realize that Mike cannot see my head, and reluctantly pull back the covers and sit up. I have some documents to go through. I really should have started on it last night. I yawn.
But you were avoiding calling your mother,
Mike says pointedly.
Understood.
After Mike had gone to sleep, I stayed up and binge-watched Netflix with a carton of ice cream to keep me company. Whatever secrets SC had entrusted me with, I did not want them. At least not yet. My head felt like it was too crowded already, and I needed some time to decompress. If I couldn't visit the horses, well, old episodes of Gilmore Girls would have to do. When Mike wandered through the living room around 2 a.m. to get a drink of water, he just rolled his eyes and went back to bed. Now, he pulls on a sweatshirt and begins fishing through his drawer for socks.
I have study group for dinner. Will you be all right?
Sure. It's not as if she's going to come up here and hunt me down.
That's not what I meant,
he says, sitting on the edge of the bed, socks in hand. I'll be fine, I reassure him. He leans across the bed to kiss me and then goes. I stare at the ceiling for a while longer, not yet ready to face the day. Finally, I get up and slip my arms into my robe, drop the flash drive into my pocket, and move in the direction of the kitchen in search of caffeine. Since my espresso yesterday had kept me up half the night, I settle for tea. Pulling a blanket around my shoulders, I sit on the couch and open up my laptop. But instead of plugging in the flash drive, I find myself on my mother's website, the one dedicated to advocating for the release of Quentin Ames. It's been updated since I last visited it. She must have recruited someone with a fairly decent graphic design background. She was good at that, recruiting. Quentin Ames was why we stayed at Black Rock well into the winter. But Mama was the reason people came in the first place. They trusted her. And if Mama believed that Ames was right about the second coming of Christ, they figured they should show up to see for sure. Then, when the feds arrived, it became more than that. It became an us-versus-them situation. We were up against the world. There was no backing down from that. At least not until justice was shot. Mama's website is chock-full of testimonials from those who've been touched by Quentin Ames's ministry. It seems he's continued to preach from within the penitentiary. He writes a weekly sermon and sends it to Mama, and then she posts it online. There's a delay, of course, and sometimes his letters are lost. Censored, Mama would say. Other times, he preaches to her directly during their visits, and she writes down what he's saying as best she can. She even took a class in shorthand specially, so that what she posts later more accurately reflects what Quentin Ames has said. Mama isn't the only one who visits him, but she's the only one who's allowed to be a conduit for his word. Most of the testimonials are from women, many of whom have driven hours to see him in person. They write about how it feels to be in his presence, and though I don't want to admit it, I remember and I know that much of what they write is true. Quentin Ames is, a narcissist and probably a sociopath as well. But when he looked at you, the world seemed brighter. The sun shone hotter. Even as a child, I felt it. Even on the worst days we had at Black Rock, the coldest, the ones when there was not enough food to eat or Mo Laramie was in a temper or the ice had gotten up underneath the roof in the back corner of the visitor center and it had started to leak. A look from Quentin Ames could make it all feel worth it. I remember that Justice had gotten into a fight with one of the Nichols boys about why they didn't bring back more game when they went out hunting. She had taken to counting their bullets in secret and finally came out and accused them of wasting ammunition on target practice or else being terrible shots. I'm not sure which one she thought was worse, But it had been made clear to the teenagers that if they were to be allowed to go out hunting on their own, there shouldn't be any fooling about. Even then, before the snows, it was getting harder to sneak out to get supplies. Quentin Ames and Pa had both said that bullets needed to be rationed the same as anything else, so what Justice was accusing the Nichols brothers of doing would have repercussions with the grown-ups if any of it were true. The older boy, whose name I can't remember, said that he shouldn't have to answer to a little girl. Justice's eyes flared. Her chin jutted out, and the younger of the brothers laughed and pointed and teased her about looking like she might cry. But he misunderstood her expression, because Justice wasn't a crybaby. The glint in her eye was anger, not the welling up of tears. Without a word, Justice snatched the rifle out of the hand of the closer of the two boys and stormed out of the visitor center. After trading a look of surprise, the Nichols boys chased her outside, with Ginny and me tagging along behind them. But Justice was already gone. She had disappeared into the woods. Not long after, we heard a single shot, and Justice appeared a short time later, dragging a wild turkey by its neck. She threw it down at the feet of Nichols the older and handed back the gun. She stormed back toward the visitor center without a word, and that was when Quentin Ames appeared. He knelt before her, and I saw the knots go out of her shoulders, saw her tightly clenched fists relax. Quentin Ames placed his palms on Justice's cheeks. He kissed the top of her head. Then he spun her narrow body around, and she walked back to the Nichols boys.
I shouldn't have taken your rifle without permission. I'm sorry.
Justice never apologized without a lingering note of resentment. But on this occasion, there was none. That was what Quentin Ames did. He took all the anger that existed in your body and simply drained it away.
We're sorry, too, one of the Nichols boys replied. We shouldn't have made fun.
If it had always been like that, then I might have grown up to be like those women who visited Quentin Ames in prison. I might have believed in his goodness, too. But what I slowly realized was that every time he did something like he did that day with Justice, every time he soothed and relieved a person of their fury, leaving them with calm, he did not destroy it. Instead, he gathered all that bile, that wrath, and held onto it. He was saving it for later, for when the feds surrounded us, for when he wanted us to be ready for a fight. He wanted to go down in a blaze of glory. He just chickened out in the end. The phone rings and rings and no one answers. Mama got rid of the answering machine after Justice died, and they never got another. I should hang up, but for some reason I find the sound comforting, and so I let it ring. I can picture it, the phone. It's mounted to the side of the pantry in the kitchen, the wire stapled against the wall and disappearing into the basement through a small hole in the floor. Yellow plastic casing. A real metal bell inside. The sort of spiraling cord that you could pull and stretch and twist between your fingers, could wrap around your wrist and body and then unwrap again. I'm taken by surprise when she does pick up after all that unanswered ringing.
Hello?
It's me, I say. I met by silence. I wonder if it's been so long that my mother doesn't recognize my voice. Then, because there's still nothing but the sound of my mother breathing, I venture. I didn't think anyone was home.
Your father is just out with Topher, running the north fence. Had a storm last week that brought some branches down, and the fence didn't fare so well in places. They'll get it fixed up right by nightfall, though, I reckon.
Is Topher's shoulder still bothering him?
It's much better. I mixed him up a salve that seems to have finally got the inflammation down.
He tell you about that himself, or have you been chatting with Penny again?
I don't answer. Topher's daughter, Penelope, is only one of the ways I keep tabs on my parents and the goings-on at the ranch. And she wasn't actually the source of this particular piece of information. My mother doesn't seem to care, though, because she continues on.
No matter. I'll let him know you asked after him.
He'll be tickled.
I suppose you're calling to tell me why you don't have time to write a letter to the parole board. You needn't bother. I've seen you on the television. They must have you booked from dawn till dusk. How could you possibly have time to sit down and write one little letter?
It's not that, I insist.
Oh, no? Then your little bit of fame must really be getting to your head. Have you forgotten what Quentin has sacrificed for us?
She's referring to the fact that Ames took the fall for the entire occupation, that he made certain that no one else who was at Black Rock went to jail. It's this selflessness that makes so many women bake him cookies and write him letters. They even send him pairs of their own underwear, or so Mama once let slip before I left for college, her voice dripping with scorn. I haven't forgotten, I answer truthfully. As difficult as it is to admit, I know that even though I lost my sister at Black Rock, I could easily have lost both my parents as well.
Then why would you deny him a few minutes of your time? He would do the same for any one of us.
No, he wouldn't. He killed Justice.
Oh, honey, no he didn't. The government killed your sister. Quentin was the one who tried to save her. He just wasn't fast enough. He pushed her.
No, Mama says. Her voice is brittle.
He didn't. I won't let you say such a thing.
In the hottest part of summer, Justice and I would sneak down to the creek and climb a tree that curved up over the water. Then we would jump. Each time, until I was falling, I was never sure that I was actually going to go through with it. That's what this feels like, that moment before the fall. But then, the words start coming out of me. When Ames brought Justice out of the visitor center, there was a protest happening. Birders, mad that the park had been closed so long, angry about the damage we must be doing to the birds' breeding grounds. It was being broadcast live on the local news. I wait for my mother to object to what I have told her, but she is silent. And so I take a breath and go on. It's not what I thought I'd find when I drove over to the station, but I remembered how the cameras had sometimes been out by the entrance. I figured they might have some footage of her, of Justice. Do you remember how Ames used to make us play outside when people were watching? I got it in my head that there might be video of all of us playing hopscotch, and if there was, then finding it would be the closest I would ever get to seeing her alive again. That was how I tracked down the tape. It never got picked up nationally. The FBI had taken a copy, of course, in case they ever needed it at trial. But the station still had the original footage. There was no cover-up, no government conspiracy. It was in a closet less than an hour away from where Justice died, less than 45 minutes from our house. All those years, and you never even went looking for answers. It was almost as if you didn't want to know. I pause again, but my mother is still silent. She's been silent for almost 20 years. Quentin Ames held Justice up in front of him to stop the bullet. It would have missed her otherwise. He lifted her up when he saw Derek Cumberland motion to the sniper, and when Justice was hit, he dropped her and left her bleeding. He could have surrendered then, but he didn't. He kept his rifle pointed at the protesters and just stood there and watched her die.
Finally, they shot Ames in the shoulder, and Derek rushed forward to put his hands over the hole in Justice's neck. I stopped to catch my breath and listen hard for any sign that my mother is still on the other end. Then I realized that it doesn't matter if she has hung up. I need to say it all. It took 213 seconds for Derek to reach Justice and put pressure on the wound. By then, the camera wasn't pointed in the right direction. The cameraman must have been getting jostled around, but you can hear the moment when Derek reached Justice and called out for help. I still wonder sometimes if it wasn't the bullet hole that killed her, but those 213 seconds... That's time that Quentin Ames stole from her. Even after he used her body as a shield, it's worse somehow that he couldn't even spare her the decency of taking off the scarf you knitted him to press it against your dying child's neck. I'm sorry, but you're wrong. He didn't try to save her. In fact, it was just the opposite. Please don't ever mention that man's name to me again. The FBI agent admitted culpability, Mama says next, but her voice is small. His name was Henry Morrison. He was only 2 weeks away from retirement when Justice died. Taking the blame for Justice's death was something he did to make sure our family got the highest possible settlement from the government. It was something he did for us to try to make things right. I've spoken with him. He's a good man. He's the one you should be sending home baked cookies to and whose name you should be trying to clear, not Quentin Ames. Quentin Ames is paying for his sins, and he is precisely where he deserves to be. Until you realize that, I don't have anything more to say to you. I accept the silence on the other end of the line and wait patiently for my mother to process everything I've said. Minutes pass before she whispers, "I don't believe you." "I know, and that's all right. I forgive you anyway."
"What for, exactly?"
My eyes well up, and through the prisms of the tears I see Quentin Ames with his face tilted up in rapture and Mama knitting stockings by the fire. I see Mo Laramie's foot in the pot of water and Justice striding off into the woods with the rifle she stole from the Nichols boy. And then I see the blood, the way it must have looked as it melted craters in the snow. I remember this the most clearly, even though it was Agent Morrison who saw it. And I accept the memory as a gift that he has given me to make me strong enough to say this single word. Everything. I am still shaking long after the phone goes dead. I don't move. From the living room window, I can see the balcony of the top floor apartment across the street. The door is open to the inside and a small boy appears, sitting on a wheeled animal of some sort. He coasts forward and bangs against the bars of the railing and then pushes himself back into the shadow of his living room. Over and over again, he appears only to vanish. There 1 minute, the next gone. When my phone buzzes, I cringe and decide to ignore it. I watch the boy. His head turns as if he's listening to someone speaking from inside. The phone chimes again, and this time I glance down and see that there is a text from Essie. I read the message, and it is as if the fog that had settled over me since Mike told me that I needed to call Mama has cleared. I feel lighter. Other people's problems can do that, I guess. They don't make anything better, but at least they provide a distraction. I plug in the flash drive and open a folder of documents. Each is labeled with Essie's name and a number. I open Esther 9 and read about Essie's 9th birthday party, the chocolate cake and the donkey-shaped pinata. I open Esther 10 and Esther 11, and each of them also starts with a birthday celebration. I realize that she must have started a new journal every year. Presumably they were handwritten, probably on rose-colored paper that had pictures of kittens in the bottom corner of each page. And Essie has transcribed them. There are 9 documents in total, some of which are several hundred pages long. The last is Esther 17, which is short compared to those for the rest of her teenage years. Less than 20 pages. But that's probably because it's unfinished. She's living those pages now. I scroll through the documents at random, wondering what it is that Essie means for me to see. I find it after a few hours of reading, buried 100 pages into Esther 12, the fall that Lyssa went away. As my eyes move across the screen, I feel my stomach tighten. I dial without even being aware of what I'm doing, and when Margot answers, I tell her, "You need to come over here right away." I don't wait for a response, but instead go straight back to reading. 20 minutes later, Margot lets herself in and drops onto the couch beside me. "What gives?" she asks. I blink and scroll back through the pages I've just read until I find the passage I'm looking for. I turn the screen toward Margot so that she can see. Her pupils dilate and she says, "Shit. Why do people have to be so predictable?" An hour later, we have printed Essie's journals, put them onto Margot's computer as well, and together are combing through the documents. "What exactly are we looking for? I presume not just the juicy bits," Margot asks. "I don't know. The truth, I guess."
"You can't handle the truth."
Margot prides herself on her impressions, and her Jack Nicholson is actually pretty good. I smile wanly since she's clearly waiting for a response, and throw a balled-up piece of paper at her head. Margot catches it deftly and continues. "What do we do with the truth when we find it? Will she really be willing to go on camera and talk about any of this?" I shrug. I had been wondering the same thing. Then I remember the first time Essie called me. "I've read your book," she said as I sat in the stairwell. "I think it may be time to write another." "Maybe she wants the truth to be published," I say quietly. And even as I say this out loud, I know it's true. What better way to control the narrative? She even told me what she wanted the day we met, but I didn't understand what she was talking about until just now. She wants me to turn these diaries into a book. Margot exhales bitterly. No wonder she needed to get married. She won't be able to live at home after that. She didn't mention anything about timing, but there will never be a better time than right now, right after the wedding. The whole country will have tuned in to watch the fairy tale.
"And you want to tear the curtain down."
"How can we not? Especially with the campaign, it's not just gossip anymore, it's bigger than that."
"We have less than a week, that's not enough time."
I fall back and let my head nestle between the couch cushions. Essie's already done the hard part. That's an understatement. I sit back up and turn toward Margot. "No. I mean, she's already written everything down. This is her book, not mine. It should be in her own words. They're all right here. We just have to figure out which ones matter."
"And then?"
Margot asks. "We just call up your old editor?" I shake my head. "We can't. Not without Essie's permission. It's still possible that when we're finished, she'll decide that this manuscript should never see the light of day. If she does want the truth to be out there, we publish it digitally, instantly, the minute she says go." Margot looks thoughtful, and I wait for her to say something. Finally, she says, "Do you think she realizes what this will do to her family?"
I do. In fact, I think she's counting on it.
We divide up the early journal entries and highlight the passages to be included. Not a lot, just enough to lay a framework, to pull the reader in, to remind them of the ways they've been complicit in what happened by watching Essie's family on television all these years. By the time Mike gets home, Margot is on the floor, her back against the couch and her legs stretched out beneath the coffee table. She's scooping pad thai into her mouth from a shallow plastic dish while her eyes run across her computer screen. I sit on the couch beside her, a carton of fried rice in one hand.
What happened here?
Mike asks, gesturing to the empty food containers and the stacks of paper littered across the room.
It looks like a bomb went off.
I think about how best to bring Mike up to speed. Up until now, I've censored what I say to him, mainly just talked about the interviews themselves. I didn't know how to make him understand why I like Essie so much, why I believe she's not just a puppet for her family's brand. But now I have proof that she's different, and that I was right. Essie wants to publish a book. She's given me all her diary entries since she was 9 years old. We're trying to figure out which bits to use. Mike snorts.
What is it with that family? Is there anything they won't try to monetize? I wouldn't be surprised if they tried to sell their dryer lint.
Mike stops. Whatever each of us may have said about the Hicks family in the past, he can tell by the way that Margot and I are looking at him that we are no longer on his side as far as Esther Hicks is concerned. The first time Essie's brother Caleb raped her, she was 12, Margot says after a long pause. She bit him, but it was clear that he liked it, so she didn't fight much after that. Mike lets this sink in. He wipes a hand over his eyes, a gesture that reminds me of my father. And I think how even though none of us really ever escapes our family, Essie has to at least get as far away as she can.
Fucker, he whispers. What can I do to help?
Margot pushes a stack of pages toward him across the coffee table, and Mike immediately drops his school bag in a corner, then sits down on the ottoman and starts to read.
Are you going to finish that?
He asks me after a while, pointing to my rice. I thought you ate at study group.
I did,
he answers,
but something tells me that I'm going to need a second wind.
I pass him the rice and we all go back to reading. It's quiet, apart from the squeaks of highlighters being drawn across paper, the tap of fingers on laptop keys. Margot shows me a page with a few paragraphs that she's selected and I nod. After a long while, Mike says,
the relationship with Rourke is a sham.
I think we all knew that, Margot replies.
Rourke's family is in a lot of debt, as he planned to have her mother approach his parents and offer to pay everything off.
How much are they getting? I ask.
It doesn't say. It looks like this was written before she knew for sure the deal would be accepted, but I expect it must be a lot.
I jiggle a pen back and forth between two fingers as I consider this. That doesn't paint any of them in a good light, does it? They sound like mercenaries. Essie wouldn't have included this information if she wasn't comfortable with my sharing it. Still, it won't exactly endear her to people. They'll be angry that they were made to believe in a love story that wasn't real. Victim or not, people will say that Essie could have handled it differently. She could have made Caleb stop without sinking to extortion, without dragging Rourke into it as well. She would have been leaving home anyway, so wouldn't she have been safe? Why did she need the money? Why did she need to lie? I start to speak, but Mike holds up his hand, palm facing out. He runs a finger down the margin of the page.
Oh, God,
he breathes. What? Margot and I both burst out at once. Mike drops the pages on his lap. The color has drained from his face. She's pregnant.
Rourke. Dad wakes me up early with a sharp rap on my door and tells me that we're going hunting. It's still dark. I blink at the ceiling, letting my eyes adjust, until I can make out the small wooden airplanes hanging from the light fixture. It's a child's room, but Mom and Dad never had the money to update it. When I turned 15, I bought a can of paint myself and covered the walls with what I thought of as a mature gray. But it came out darker than I thought it would, and made me feel like I was sleeping in a cave. As soon as I could, I painted it the light shade of green that it still is today. My ankles crack as my feet hit the floor, and I rummage through my closet and pull out my hunting gear. Dad likes to get an early start, but usually he gives me some warning the night before. I grumble as I move around the room, aware that Dad is already downstairs and can't hear. I dress, and then, after double-checking the weather, I add another layer. I carry my boots downstairs so I don't wake up Mom, and then sit down at the bottom of the staircase to put them on. Dad hands me a coffee when I reach the kitchen and watches me as I down it. I look at the clock. It's just after 5. When I've set the empty mug in the sink, Dad passes me a thermos so that I can have my second cup on the road. The cool air hits me when the door opens, and I pull my jacket up around my neck. Dad leaves footprints in the dew as he walks across the driveway, and I see that a few of Mom's tulips must have bloomed without my noticing, though they have closed their cups up tightly overnight. Dad starts to climb directly into the cab. His truck is already packed. He must have done it the night before, so there's no way this trip is a last-minute whim. I shoot him an accusing glance, and he shrugs heavily.
I was afraid you wouldn't come.
There's no place open this early, so Dad has packed breakfast as well. I gnaw on a bagel as morning bleeds into the sky. Where are we headed? I ask him.
Someplace new, he answers. Some private woods. I put the address into the GPS. The others are meeting us there.
What others?
A politician brother of your fiancé's? Probably some folks we haven't met. They told me it would be good for the store. Everyone will be using guns we sell.
So they'll be filming?
That's what they said.
I swallow hard. The wedding is coming up fast. I went along with attending Caleb's campaign event because Essie asked me to, because it seemed like it was just something we had to get through. Then, in no time, we would be married, and once that happened, we would be free of him. We would be free of them all. Now I see that I'm wrong, and that the budding politician means to capitalize on the popularity of Essie's and my little love story as much as possible before we earn the right to tell him no. I worry about how I'll make it through the day. Once I was up on stage with Caleb, it was all I could do not to punch him in the face. It probably had something to do with the way he smiled and shook hands with the crowd like a normal person, even though he's actually the lowest form of human scum. I say, good for the store? More likely it'll be good for his image to be seen with me. My likability numbers are much higher than his.
Your likability numbers? That's a thing.
When you're in the Hicks family, it is. This is what you signed me up for. Or don't you remember? Dad looks embarrassed and covers up the silence with a cough. He takes a sip from his thermos and fiddles with the radio.
I hope you know how much I...
Dad starts to say, but I cut him off. Don't worry about it. Essie's likability numbers are the highest you can get. It won't be so bad. being saddled with the likes of her. Dad lets out a, huh, and concentrates on driving. Though I haven't really